Good evening, and welcome to another in the series of medical ethics and medical halacha classes produced through the Yeshiva University, Torah Mitzion, Beit Midrash, Zichron Tov. Glad to be able, through the help of Dr. Kirshen and the University of Toronto, to offer credit as well for these classes. Please note, I'll be sending a follow-up email to anyone who signed in with a couple of things. First of all, with the online evaluation form. It's a brief evaluation, but it is necessary for us in order to be able to offer credit. It's really just like five questions, which are completely confusing for me because I'm not practicing. But even if you're not practicing, I'm not a doctor. But even if somebody isn't a practicing physician, nonetheless, please do fill out that form when I send that out by email. Also, I will be sending out the source sheets, a digital version of the source sheets, which will be especially important because there are actually three sources that I added at the end today that don't appear on the sheets. Because it occurred to me that I ought to add them, so I added them. You don't have it. Your sheets stop at a certain number, and then there are three more. But when I send it out by email, it will be on the email. I want to thank Ben and Roz Schultz for dedicating the evening's program. And last introductory note, if you have a cell phone and you could please put it on silent or vibrate, I'd appreciate it. So our topic this evening is informing a patient of a terminal diagnosis. We're not limiting it to terminal. It's really informing a patient of bad news in general. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You know, I help this suggestion.
Thank you. So the first source I brought you on the sheets is from the first Code of Ethics of the Canadian Medical Association, 1868. Take a look at this. Physicians should unite tenderness with firmness and condescension with authority, and thus inspire their patients with gratitude, respect, and confidence. I think condescension meant something different in 1868, I'm pretty sure. It goes on. A physician should studiously avoid making gloomy prognostications as they savor of empiricism and magnify the importance of his services to the treatment of the disease. Empiricism is the idea that you can come to conclusions based on experience as opposed to rational thought. So that's a no-no, apparently, referring to experience. You're supposed to go only based on proper theory. But he should not fail. He should not fail. That's a gender assumption there. Okay. But he should not fail on proper occasions to give to the friends of the patient timely notice of danger when it really occurs, and even to the patient himself if absolutely necessary. So in other words, as of 1868, you let the friends of the patient know, and if you have to, fine, let the patient know. And then I brought you one other paragraph just because I think it's part of this theme. The obedience of a patient to the prescriptions of his physician should be prompt and implicit. He should never permit his own crude opinions as to their fitness to influence his attention to them. A failure in one particular may render an otherwise judicious treatment dangerous and even fatal. This remark is equally applicable to diet, drink, and exercise. As patients become convalescent, they are very apt to suppose that the rules prescribed for them may be disregarded, and the consequence, but too often, is a relapse. So if you are a patient, you want to listen to your doctor. If you are a doctor, you want to tell the patient what to do. Occasionally, you might let the patient know what's going on, but basically, you're better off not doing so. It only encourages them to think independently. I should note, this is not exclusively Canadian, because this was lifted, as was most of the Canadian Code of Ethics, the original Code of Ethics of the Canadian Medical Association was lifted from the American Medical Association, which had done this 20 years earlier. Of course, the idea itself is not new. This goes back to Hippocrates, as we're going to see. The idea that the physician is in charge, the medical professional is in charge, is an old idea that is amplified over time by new developments. But the question that I want to ask is, what exactly does Judaism want of the medical professional in this situation? A question which is important for the Jewish medical professional and important for a medical professional who has a Jewish patient. What exactly is the expectation within Judaism. And so I brought you two cases. Actually, before the two cases, sorry, take a look at source number two. I forgot. This is the current policy of the CPSO. Quite different from 1868. Respect for the autonomy and personal dignity of the patient is central to the provision of ethically sound patient care. Through the translation of these ethical principles to law, the Supreme Court of Canada has confirmed the fundamental right of the individual to decide which medical interventions will be accepted and which will not. In other words, patient autonomy. Right? The patient is the one who makes these decisions. The patient is the one who's going to need the information. Withholding information from the patient fundamentally harms the patient's ability to make such decisions. Yeah?
This is a question with bad news. The bad news finance, too.
Yep.
So is there a difference?
Well, I think financial advisors definitely do not like conveying bad news to their clients.
Right.
No, the answer is yes.
Like,
yes.
Why tell anyone?
Right, the answer is yes, there is a big difference. What we're going to see is that the major drive to not share the information is the belief, correct or incorrect, that the patient is in a vulnerable situation, being in ill health, and informing the patient of a bad prognosis is apt to cause stress to the patient, leading to a bad reaction that could harm the patient's chance of recovery, or, in a case that recovery is not foreseen anyway, cause the demise of the patient sooner. That's their consideration. Now, theoretically, you give somebody bad news about their RRSP, and you may have bad consequences there as well. But the assumption is that somebody who is already ill is vulnerable in a way that people, generally speaking, are not. And that's why this is going to be an issue. But we'll see. We're going to go into this. The two cases that I gave you here on the sheet in source number three are shorthand for what we're going to discuss. Susan, 35, is diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. The tumor has begun to spread, but her doctor believes that treatment options may be effective. May Susan's doctor inform her of the full nature of her illness and its extent? Now, from a CPSO perspective, this is a no-brainer. This is a non-starter. Of course, you have a full discussion with the patient. The patient has the right to consult whomever the patient wishes to consult, make the decision, and then the medical staff are responsible to carry out the decision of the patient. It's fairly straightforward. We're going to discuss this more from the Jewish perspective. Yes?
Not
one. Okay.
Patient has the right to decide how to receive the information. The original Supreme Court ruling on informed consent said similar patient, similar background might ordinarily want to know. And that has been turned into, the lawyer says, if you don't tell them, I'm going to sue you.
Right.
So it's far more nuanced than you're making out.
Fair. I'm working with the general practice, but you're right. From letter of the law perspective, it's not quite that that there is that hard and fast a duty to tell. And for that matter, you could make the point that it isn't quite a hard and fast duty to carry out the patient's wishes. If the patient expresses a desire for a treatment that the physician says is entirely ineffective and inappropriate, the physician is not bound, as I understand it. The patient is told they have stage 3 breast cancer, and they say, "Well, I heard penicillin." Still in works. There's no duty to the physician to write a prescription. Yeah.
Unless they're indigenous.
Really?
A girl died of a treatable leukemia because the indigenous culture said she shouldn't get the chemo.
Right. So that raises a whole other question. Right. That raises Dr. Pito raises a whole other question, which is what about where the physician, due to the physician's background. The patient, due to the patient's background, doesn't want to get treated or insists on some particular type of treatment that's just not medically appropriate. You're right. We're going to come back to that a little bit in the context of Judaism in a bit. But that's our first case. Do you inform of a bad prognosis like that? Noticing, by the way, Jeff Lipsitz sitting over there. I hadn't seen before, but I also want to thank Jeff for his help in setting up the series of medical classes. Thank you. I'm sorry?
Does her ask?
Absolutely. We're going to come back to it. I'm just giving you the cases right now.
A lot of these things were written or thought of long before there was such a thing as an internet, which is full of and Wikipedia. And
quite
all,
true.
All the knowledge. So people don't come into it, even if they, they're not asking.
Right.
They're knowledgeable, most of them, when they come.
Right.
In.
So Dr. Roth makes the point that patients are walking in with a wealth of knowledge potentially that they have no idea how to use. And yes, that's something we're going to have to talk about. All of this is going to play out. Right now, I'm just presenting the cases. The second one, it's good. It's a feisty group. The second case in source number 3, Sam, 54, is in what the doctors believe to be the last stages of pancreatic cancer. Sam has tried every available therapy without success, but he still holds out hope for a new development. May Sam's physician recommend hospice care, whether inpatient or at home, in order to provide better pain management and a more peaceful environment? Now, why is this a question? Well, yes, the patient is terminal, but why is this a question?
Sam's not on the same page. He's not ready to...
Right. Sam is not on the same page. By telling Sam that it's time for hospice, you may be conveying a message, willingly or not, that this is the end, we have nothing else that we can do for you, and therefore, indirectly, we're conveying this news that we're potentially afraid to convey. I haven't actually said anything from a Jewish perspective yet. All we've done is talked about 1868 and 2017. Esther.
Nowadays, I believe that it can, I know, that it can be used alongside action.
Right.
So I think if it's stressed to the patient that it can provide supportive measures and less pain relief, and it doesn't mean that we're not going to treat you.
Right. Quite correct. We're going to come back to that point. That's actually within the three sources that I added to the source sheet today, but I will be reading them out so you will hear them. Absolutely 100% true and definitely part of this conversation. So, okay, what we've set up right now is that the general practice today is to inform, whether that is a legal requirement, hard and fast, or not. That is the general practice of medicine today. It was not always the case, and now I want to shift to talk about, within Judaism, what the sources have to say. So we're going to talk about two debates and an ethical conundrum. The first debate is regarding patient autonomy. We said before that if you go back to the times of the Greeks, we're talking Plato, we're talking Hippocrates, you had a basic paternalistic view that said the expert knows and the expert tells the patient whatever the expert believes will help the patient follow instructions. That's more or less the way you want to practice. If you take a look at source number 4, Instructions of Hippocrates, he said, "Fulfill your obligation to the patient in tranquility and for his benefit. Most matters should be withheld from the patient when you treat him. Instruct the patient in a pleasant and positive manner, but divert his mind from what is being done for him. At times, you must deflect the patient's mind in a sharp manner, whereas other times you should calm his mind, but without revealing to him his true condition or the prognosis." That shifts, as we said, by today. And there are a few reasons for that shift that go back well before there was an internet for people to do research. What motivated the shift away from this kind of paternalism?
Lawyers.
So the cynical answer is lawyers. Take a look at source number 5. Jonathan Will, A Brief Historical and Theoretical Perspective. While physicians did develop a more consistent practice of obtaining patient consent in the early 20th century, the medical literature indicates that the practice was fueled more by a desire to respond to lawsuits than by a moral imperative to respect patient autonomy. In a 1911 article, physician George W. Gay suggested that, quote, "careful and explicit explanations of the nature of serious cases, together with the complications liable to arise and their probable termination, be given to the patient for our own protection." In Schloendorf v. Society of New York Hospitals, Justice Cardozo planted the seed for what would become the informed consent doctrine when he wrote, "Every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body. And a surgeon who performs an operation without his patient's consent commits an assault for which he is liable in damages." And those are scary words. Right? Once you hear that you could be liable for assault, it becomes very clear that you want to tell the patient everything and let the patient make the decision and provide the consent. And this shift is not just a shift that takes place in North America. This is a global shift. In an article by Professor Shimon Glick in Israel, he quoted two polls, fascinating polls done in Europe. 1961, 90% of polled physicians said not to tell the patient openly. Poll is repeated in 1977. Only 2% say not to tell the patient openly. A radical and dramatic shift over a relatively short period of time. Now, the truth of the matter is that this is still shifting somewhat and back in the other direction. Because one of the principles of consent is that we want informed consent. And the point is made that the patients, even if you tell them everything, don't really, especially in that environment, don't really comprehend what it is that they're being told. Right? You have somebody who's brought into the hospital and has to deal with a diagnosis of a tumor, with a diagnosis of a heart problem, a diagnosis of fill in the blank, whatever it is, and you give them a crash course in their condition and say, here are three choices now for what to do. Is the patient, or for that matter, the patient's family, whoever the patient's going to consult, really in a position at this point to make a decision on this? And so there's a lot of literature on this issue of informed consent and what really constitutes informed consent. But that's really not where we're going. We're just talking about whether you tell the patient in the first place. So I'm not veering into the informed consent. Is this informed consent question? Or
even before you tell them, there's an obligation to ask. So I'm not saying you have to or you don't have to, but even before I get there, I need to know what this person wants. So I think there's actually a step before you disclose anything.
What do you mean by what the person wants?
The person has a right to say, I want more information, or I don't want information. Talk to my husband, my father.
Right, that's the point that Dr. Kirshen was making before, that the patient has the ability to say, I don't want, and I'm going to be coming back to that later on, because I think it's an important point. Or to say, I do want, correct. This is the issue of patient autonomy in general society. So what about in Judaism? In Judaism in general, would you say that, based on your own familiarity, that there is or is not a concept of patient autonomy?
None,
less, right? Generally speaking, that is the assumption that people have, is that your duty is indeed to follow doctor's orders. We have a mitzvah from the Torah, v'nishmartem ma'od l'nafshoseichem, you are required to guard your life, and as that's been interpreted by the sages down through the ages, that has meant, listen to somebody who has the training, and is telling you, this is what you ought to do in your particular situation. Classic passage in the Talmud deals with somebody who is weak on Yom Kippur, right? They're fasting on Yom Kippur, they feel weak, the doctor says, you need to eat. The patient says, no, I don't. Who do you follow? The doctor. 100 times out of 100, you follow the doctor. You do not listen to the patient. If you take a look at source number 6, I brought you a passage from Ramban, Nachmanides, in his Torah HaAdam, which deals with medical issues. And he deals with the question of how you decide between medical opinions. He says, "V'minyan shaveh berofim." The Hebrew is on the bottom of one side, the English is the top of the second side. "V'minyan shaveh berofim." If you have an equal vote among physicians, where it's 50-50, one way, you have half on one side, half on the other side, so you look at who is more knowledgeable, you look at who is more expert. If it's 1 versus 2, then kevin shekulan rofim v'yodim b'malachazu, since they are all doctors and they all know the trade, ein dvarav shel yachid b'makom shnayim, I'm going to go with the majority against the minority. But mikol makom b'muflag mehem b'chokma, if one of them is known to be much greater in wisdom, choshen l'dvarav l'hachmir, then we're going to follow him and be strict, afilu b'makom rabim, even against the majority. Strict on the side of saving the patient and being concerned to make sure that the patient's health is going to be protected. But the point is that you're always going with the greater level of expertise. That's the trend, and that seems to dictate then that we're not going to be concerned about autonomy, not going to be concerned about what the patient wants, and only where the doctors themselves are uncertain is there room for a patient to say, I'm not interested. That's when the patient has the option to say, I'd rather not follow the advice that I am getting. If you take a look at source number 7, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, writing in the 18th century, says, "B'chol yumaka shebegalui, if you're dealing with an illness or a visible wound, sheyesh l'rofe yediyah vada'it, so that the doctor has definite knowledge, v'hakara b'ra b'em, and he has a clear understanding of it, v'oseik b'trufa b'duka u'gmura, and he's using a tested, known treatment, v'alei la'olam kofen l'chol ha'misarei b'makom sakara, then we would compel a recalcitrant patient." How you compel, whether to compel, is actually a very interesting discussion that's not for right now. Suffice it to say, it doesn't mean that you're, you know, tying them up and forcing this down the patient's throat, but it's its own discussion. I bring this source only to say that he has qualified the advice. Right? You have to be dealing with a visible wound. You have to be dealing with something that you can see and know, and you're dealing with a tested treatment. If you don't have that level of certainty, then all bets are off. However, even though it is definitely true that the weight of Jewish tradition is on the side of the physician decides and the patient says thank you, nonetheless, there are sources that go in a different direction. In other classes, when we've discussed the issue of end-of-life care and the right of a patient to say, I don't want to go down that road. The doctor says, listen, if you want, I can try another round of chemo. And the ability of the patient to say, I'd rather not pursue that route. The position of Rav Herschel Schechter, which we've discussed, is that the patient is not obligated. It depends on what we're talking about. I should clarify that. In the event that it's the type of treatment which your average person on the street may well decline, then the Jewish patient as well is entitled to decline. There is that level of autonomy. Even when the doctor says, look, I could give this to you and it could extend your life by a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is, it's within the patient's right to decline. There is a level of autonomy there in that position. All right.
This is another context. Mental illness is intrigued. That or delirium.
So that's a whole other discussion about capacity. If you ask me after, I'll give you a link. I taught a class on capacity here about 5 years ago, so I can give you the link to that. But it's a very good question, just beyond the scope of what I'm going to get to right now. But one... Sorry?
Why does he have the autonomy to say not to and not say, I don't want anything?
Right. So the basis is a Gemara Bava Kama Kuf Yud Beis. The Gemara there, very briefly, because it's not really the topic tonight, but it is worth knowing. The passage in the Talmud is talking about a worker and the biblical obligation to pay a worker on time. And the way the Talmud frames it is that how dare you delay paying? This person puts his life on the line in order to work for you. He climbs a tree, goes up on a ladder, whatever it is, he endangers himself. So Schechter points out that you're telling me that this person is justified in taking a risk, in endangering his health, in order to make a living. Who allowed him to do that? And the answer is, as seen in various Talmudic sources, that there is such a concept as normal risk. What people would consider to be a normal danger, and you're allowed to enter it for a perceived benefit. And he applies that to the medical situation and says that in the event that somebody that it's a situation where many people would decline, then the patient has the right to decline as well. If you want to discuss further, we can after. But sorry? Okay. We can talk about it later. He's not the only one. The Stipler, the Kilas Yaakov, wrote a letter in which he said, I don't know where the idea has come from that a person has to try every single possible treatment. He was pretty from the Stipler. And that was his position. Okay. So that's one sort of caveat on this idea of patient autonomy or limiting patient autonomy. The other one is a point made by Dr. Judah Goldberg in an article in Tradition in source number 14. He points out, I'm sorry, no, yes, number 8. Thank you, number 8. I'm working with two sheets in front of me. There we go. In number 8. He says, one only begins to realize how subjective a business medicine can be when several different consultants weigh in on a given case, each with a different area of specialization, and provide fundamentally discordant accounts of what is wrong and how to fix it. Worse, they may sometimes make little effort to reconcile their collective incongruities, leaving it to the patient to make sense of his or her situation. In other words, doctors do not resolve medical uncertainty. They exacerbate it.
It sounds like someone was turned down from medical school.
No. He has a medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania. Rather than simplify medical decisions, the involvement of a physician adds another layer of complexity, as physicians themselves constitute just another variable in the guessing game of healthcare. Finally, as Benjamin Friedman notes, the uncertainties of medical treatment do not disappear as therapeutic options fade and death becomes inevitable. They intensify. Which aggressive life-supporting measures should be taken and in what context? With what cost to the patient, whether in terms of side effects, discomfort, or risk? Every step of medical care is riddled with decisions, and every medical decision entails some element of ambiguity. And his point is, if you're telling me that Rabbi Yaakov Emden says that the doctor is the one who decides when the doctor knows with certainty, then my question to you is, when does a doctor know with certainty? We don't live in the same world that the Talmud was living in which it was fairly straightforward. Your selection of diagnoses was not this very long list. You didn't have a compendium of symptoms and options, and then all the different treatments and levels of treatment. And in modern medicine, occupies a world of uncertainty. So those are the two caveats when it comes to the statement that you just have to listen to the doctor. But it's true still, overall, that patient autonomy is generally assumed to be a modern concept, and that Jewish tradition, generally speaking, has recommended go with what the doctor tells you. That's who you're supposed to follow. Jeffrey.
So isn't the Rambam
Yes, Ramban is giving you some advice in that regard. The piece that we saw in source number 6 saying, well, if the doctors are even in it, then you'll ask, you'll go with the one with greater experience, greater wisdom. Otherwise, if there's a majority, you go with the majority, unless one in the minority is greater. But you can hear how vague those lines are when it comes to real-world application, particularly in the age of globalization, right? I could call up an expert in Japan, right? Does that expert count in the vote? Yes. Right, but what about when they start calling in specialists and consulting others, and you can find all the information you want? It becomes much harder to apply what may have at one point seemed like simple rules. So that's our first dilemma. That's our first problem, is patient autonomy. Our second problem is the question of whether negative information will impact the patient's health. I see many medical professionals here who know far better than I do the impact of stress on anyone in the best of circumstances, let alone somebody whose health is precarious. Whether you're talking about the cardiovascular system, whether you're talking about neurological issues, whether you're talking about the immune system, all sorts of different problems, all stemming from the fight or flight response. When this person hears somebody say, there's nothing more we can do, when they hear somebody say, I estimate 3 to 6 months, or fill in the blank with whatever prediction you wish, that the response that the patient is going to have is going to be a stressed response. Elsewhere in a separate class, I talk about stress versus eustress, and the idea that stress can actually be helpful, but generally speaking, this is not one of those stresses that people find helpful. The impact can be dramatic. And so the argument will go, don't give the patient bad news. You want to protect the patient's health. If you take a look at source number 9, passage out of the Talmud. Cholesh ames lo mes, if a patient's relative dies, Ein modian oso shemes, we don't let him know about the death. Shema titrav daito alav, lest his mind be torn. Right? That's an expression. Mind being torn is an expression for an extreme reaction to stress in which a person cannot function because they are so upset. So we don't tell him. He won't sit Shiva, he won't sit Shiva. That's the way it goes. We don't want to endanger his health. Source number 10. Another passage deals with the issue of what's called a Shriv Mirah. Shriv Mirah means a person who is so ill they're considered to be on their deathbed. Normally, in order to execute any kind of a financial action, if a person wants to give away items, a person wants to sell items, you require what's called a kinyan. You require an act of transaction. However, in the event that a person is on his deathbed, then the rule is, even if he just makes a declaration, assuming he is confident at the time that he makes the declaration, that's good enough. Why? Because we are afraid that if he knows that you're not listening, if he knows that what he says is not going to be taken seriously, then again, it will be bad for his mental state. So therefore, we say, we make an exception, whatever he says is done. That's another example of it. I bring you one more example. Source number 11. 11 is not dealing with somebody who is already ill. This is a bit of an odd passage. Person wants to embark on the road. In the interest of time, I'm just going to read out the English. You have the original there as well, but I think I'm just going to stick with the English for the rest of the sources. Someone wants to go traveling. He wants to know whether he's going to return home or not. Here's the method. This is how you know. Stand in a darkened house. If he sees a shadow of a shadow, and if you ask me what that means, my answer is I don't know. If he sees a shadow of a shadow, perhaps some level of detail in the shadow, so he should know he's going to return home. That's how you know you'll be safe. But don't do it. Because he might become upset, and his mazel may be harmed. Leave aside this specific skula that we're talking about, this non-scientific method of telling the future, because it's not the point. I don't want to get distracted by, you know, the story about the guy going on the road. The point is, they're saying, we don't want you to do this because you endanger yourself by trying to know your future. Yes?
Maybe I'm naive, but I don't think the bad of the stress is always all bad. It can actually be some good things that come out of the person knowing the information, things that they may not have done, now they'll do.
Yep.
Things that is a resolution. So it can actually be significant.
You bet. I'm coming back to it. You're 100% right. And that's one of the points that's made in response. Not only in terms of things that the patient could do, because we're going to have to talk about the practical, but also just in terms of the emotional closure of having knowledge as opposed to living in limbo or living with some kind of a half explanation that doesn't really satisfy and you know something else is going on and they're not telling you. So you're right. There are significant positives potentially to knowing as well, and they may even outweigh the concern for stress. Yes?
Hi. Such a pleasure to be here. I think it's funny because I'm actually just a patient.
Okay.
And it's pretty personal. I have, really bad feelings, but I fall in the mental health realm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an involuntary patient. I take medication that's enforced right now. There's been times where it hasn't been enforced. And I completely disagree. But I go back to this joke where I don't know if you've already brought it up. The guy goes in and he's terminal to the doctor and the doctor says, you have 6 months to live. He says, well, is there anything we can do about this? And he pays his bill and says, I'll give you another 6 months.
Got it.
That was a bad joke there on the real intelligence side shows that, you know, agreeing with the doctor or following the doctor in any sense of the word is almost lunacy.
All right. Well, I thank you for the joke, but I'm not going to take that one further. But you have these passages, Talmudic passages, going back a tradition of a couple of thousand years, that argue for not giving somebody bad news because of the impact on their health. Take a look at source number 12. Keep in mind that this is written in the 16th century, and do not be offended. Okay, I tell you that right now. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, is talking about instructing a patient to confess. instructing a patient, there's no concept in Judaism of confessing to a priest. But there is a concept that before a person is going to pass away, they should have an opportunity to do vidui between themselves and God. They can be helped by somebody, but fundamentally it's between themselves and God to acknowledge that which they've done that was wrong and to ask God for forgiveness. So Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law, after describing how we broach the subject with the patient, which we're going to come back to, he says we don't speak of all of this, the whole confession, before the unlearned, before women, or before children, lest they cry and break his heart. Yes, men cry too. Okay? I'm willing to stipulate that. Nonetheless, the stereotype is that it's the women, it's the children who won't realize, and they're going to be sensitive and they'll be moved and they'll cry, and you don't want him to be put into this bad state. I'll move to the 20th century. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein deals with the following difficult case. You have a patient in the ICU. There isn't anything you can really do at this point, or there's something minimal that you can do. Another patient comes along, needs the ICU, and the prognosis there is that if given the right treatment, this patient can actually be cured. Do you displace the patient who's in there right now in favor of the patient who has a long-term prognosis? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein talks about the possibilities here, and he makes a very important point in number 13. He says, this substitution may be done only in a way that the dangerously ill patient will not know that the doctors think they cannot heal him. If this would cause him to know that they cannot heal him, he would be frightened, and this would hasten his death, his mind would be torn. This is always prohibited. There are other complications in the substitution case. I'm not going into it. I just wanted to show you this concern again for the impact on a patient's mental state. I'm coming back to it. Don't worry. But that's one side of this point, is you can cause harm to the patient. We know that stress is harmful potentially, depending again on how someone takes the news. But generally speaking, people don't take this kind of news well. The fear is you're damaging the patient's health by giving them this information. Once again, though, just like with patient autonomy, there's another side to it.
When you're talking about the information being given,
yeah,
are you talking about the specialist you go to once who's doing it, or are you talking about somebody who's known this individual for some period of time, their context and so on, therefore has already got a longer-term trust relationship?
Right, so that's a good point. I was going to come back to this at the end. So maybe I will. I expect there will be time for it, because I had a few notes on when telling, how to tell. And that's where I would include that point that you're making. Yes, Ellen.
It's a terminal diagnosis. I mean, it's not so much that telling the person is going to shorten their life. It's already more or less dictated by the illness. But it's just like, it's just an awful way for some people to live. Like, some people are okay with that, and some people just don't want to know. Like, and they just really don't. And they're, you know, their will is in place, everything's done, you know, there are no practical things that are going to be affected by the holding information. But your patient is giving a message that they don't want the gory details.
Right, so Ellen makes the point that it may not have anything to do with harming the patient's health, but simply the patient doesn't want to know. So here I would draw an important distinction. If you're dealing with a patient who just doesn't want to know, we talked about this a little bit before, and I am going to come back to it, that the patient has the opportunity to say, this is the way I want to be dealt with, and to express that. But in order to create an imperative of don't tell, which is what we're going to see in many halachic works, it has to be stronger than just some patients don't want to know. You're going to create an imperative. It has to be founded on the idea that it's actually harmful to the patient, and especially because we're now dictating a rule for patients we've never met who haven't expressed a desire. But the response to this, and this is a point that was already started on earlier, the response to this statement that it's stressful for the patient comes in the form of various studies which have been done, which argue that there is no negative effect on the patient, and in fact, it can even be positive. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, famous for her work on death and dying and grief and grieving, did studies on 200 patients and found that they went through the stages that she famously identified for grieving, and they came to acceptance at the end, and this did not harm their health. And other similar studies have been done. And the argument goes that that even though there's a concept, Talmudically, that you could harm the patient's health with bad news, it's not necessarily borne out by evidence today. That's one argument. A second similar argument is made in that article I mentioned earlier by Dr. Goldberg. Take a look at source number 14. He writes the following. I had a communication back and forth with him today by email, and he clarified what he meant. But let's read the quote first. He says, regarding the interplay between psychology and biology, the gap between the outlook of Chazal, our sages, and the perspective of contemporary medicine is multidimensional. First, whereas Chazal breathed and functioned in an essentially Aristotelian world that took the seamless unity of both existence and knowledge for granted, modern science operates within a fractious intellectual outlook that utterly forbids the mixing of spirit and material substance. Accordingly, while Chazal might have embraced spiritual or psychological explanations for disease, contemporary medicine insists upon organic theories. Stress as the basis for stomach ulcers has been replaced by bacterial infection. Freudian descriptions of neurosis have given way to hormonal imbalances in the brain. The same holds true for the hypothesis that any degree of mental distress can be lethal for a fragile patient. What for Chazal might have seemed intuitive to the point of obvious is at best eyed with wariness by modern medicine, and at worst with derision. He argues that in our day, scientific theory rejects the idea that bad news is going to affect your physical health. So I emailed him because I couldn't believe that someone could actually write that. I mean, the whole field of psychology and the whole... there's so much literature on this, on stress and stress reactions and so on and so forth. I had a very hard time believing that somebody could really say that the mind and the body operate in entirely different realms and bad news is never going to affect your health. So he said that wasn't quite what he meant. I emailed him back with the quote, and I haven't heard back yet. He's in Israel, so there's a time gap here. It was night by the time I emailed him back. But that's what he sounds like he's saying here, and the argument that he's presenting is that we don't accept the idea that even if it makes sense logically that it should affect your health, that doesn't necessarily mean it does. You need to do studies in order to determine that it actually will impact on a person's health. That's the argument that he's giving. Yeah?
But look at the time. Published in 2010, it was written in 2008, and a lot of the more recent data that's come out has come out since then. So
you think in those days that they... Could be. I mean...
Here's the end of an era that he was writing.
Uh-huh. Could be. Well, he's defending it in 2017, so I don't know. Yes?
If you say that Bob Spreyson doesn't accept that, why is that found?
So Dr. Sturm asks a very important question. He says, even if someone wants to make that contention today, why would that affect the calculus of Jewish law? And the answer to that is going to come in the form of a comment by Rabbi Yigal Shaffrin. We're not there yet. But he is going to point out that if the fundamental goal is the benefit of the patient, and it determined that what benefited the patient or was believed to benefit the patient long ago no longer benefits patients, then the answer will be, my goal remains the benefit of the patient, and now this is the way I help patients instead of that way. That would be the argument that would be presented. We do that in other areas, where you define what your goal is, and if the advice that you follow in order to get to that goal has to change because the reality is different, then you follow a different set of advice. That's a valid point within halacha. Or saying nishtana hateva, whichever you like, right? That the world is a different world. You can say whichever you like, whatever makes you more comfortable. But that's your second debate. Your first debate is patient autonomy, on which the majority view in Jewish tradition certainly is. You follow what the doctor says. The patient does not need to have all the information. even though I noted that there are other possibilities. And then your second, the concern that negative information may impact health. And again, classically, the belief has been negative information can harm the vulnerable, even though there is this dissenting perspective that says we do studies now and find that people do okay. Yes, and then yes.
I think, with all due respect, that it's you're putting forward a very sort of rudimentary black and white definition of stress. And as a psychiatrist in palliative care, end of life and stress is my daily work. And I think that stress is a complicated term, it's a complicated experience. And for many people, what initially is a negative stress becomes something positive.
Yes.
And so that this sort of all or nothing stress is bad stress. That, I mean, what Goldberg is saying does not seem impossible to me at all, because I see over and over again people who take a stressor, and because we're resilient pretty much as a species, grow from that stress into and turn it into something positive.
Right.
So that I think it's really dangerous to say stress is
right.
And that is health, because there's something. There's something between being told a diagnosis and dying.
Right.
Right? There's a whole process there.
Right. No, and I hear it, and that was my allusion to eustress before, is the fact that it's true. The way that one chooses to respond to stress will define whether it's going to have a negative or a positive impact. But I think you're pointing to something that's really crucial in this black and white versus gray area. And that is a point that Rabbi J. David Bleich makes in an article, which I'm going to refer to later, on this, which is, when you're dealing with issues of life and death, the general rule is we err on the side of caution to protect life. And so if you can't make an argument to me that there's a necessity for the patient to know this, out of fear that telling the patient could harm, I'm going to err on the side of saving the patient's life. It's the same rule that will say, if it's Shabbat and somebody falls down the steps and bangs their head, you're driving them to the hospital and not saying, well, you know, I could observe them for a couple of hours and see what's going on. No, you drive them to the hospital. Right? It's the same principle of erring on the side of protecting life, just applied in a situation in which modern medicine may be a little less comfortable. Modern medicine is very happy when we say, drive the patient to the hospital, even if it's Shabbat. Less comfortable when we say, protect the patient's health by not informing the patient. But it's the same principle in both cases. So that's you're right, clearly, and it's your field, about the gray area that exists. But in terms of recommendations of Jewish law, certainly when you're not dealing with a particular case, but you're dealing with an at-large rule, the assumption is going to be, let's err on the side of caution if we have a doubt. That would be the response to it. Yes?
I'm just telling them to let them know the situation. Or, no, I'm telling them to do it now. They're going to choose different things.
Right.
Does that make
makes a big difference. We should be there shortly. It makes a big difference. The last piece of this introduction, right, because all of this is really until we get to our cases. But we talked about patient autonomy, we dealt with the issue of affecting health, now we have to deal with the ethical conundrum, which is the issue of truth-telling in Judaism. The Torah is filled with passages that say not to lie, and that emphasize the importance of truth. The Talmud observes that God's seal is truth. We have a verse that says, you shall not lie in testimony. We have another one that says, distance yourself from falsehood. We have another one that says, one shall not lie against another. We have another one that says, do not swear in my name in vain. We have over and over again statements within the Torah that say that one must stay very far from falsehood. Having said that, take a look at source number 15. Passage out of the Talmud. Rabbi Elah taught, quoting Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, one may deviate for the sake of peace. You don't have to tell quite the truth. And they quote you a verse in Genesis in Bereshit. Joseph has been sold by his brothers down to Egypt. Fast forward, Joseph has now been found by his brothers down in Egypt. He has told them who he is. They have this big reunion in Egypt. The family comes to move down to Egypt. Joseph's father dies. At that point, Joseph's brothers are afraid that Joseph is going to punish them for what they did all those years ago. Now that Dad isn't around, he's going to take it out on us. And they say to Joseph, "Our father said, please forgive the sin of your brothers." Now, the Talmud's view is that there never was any such conversation between their father and the brothers. They made it up. Why did they make it up? Not to save their lives, but rather in order to preserve peace. That's the way that the Talmud reads the story. They're trying to preserve peace, and therefore they lied, and it must be justified because after all, they went and did it. Second passage, Rabbi Natan taught, not only is it justified, but it is a mitzvah. And he quotes the passage in which the prophet Shmuel, Samuel, is told to do something which, generally speaking, is a no-no, and particularly in the Middle East. Generally speaking, when somebody is king, you don't appoint somebody else as king, right? While the first one is alive, don't appoint the next one. And particularly, again, Middle East, very bad idea. But that's what happened. Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, is the king. God says to Shmuel, to the prophet Samuel, he says, go coronate David. And Samuel says cogently, well, Saul's going to hear and he's going to kill me. And God then says, okay, so tell him you're going there to do something else. But what happened? That's a lie. Okay, keep the peace. And then a third example of it, the story of Sarah and Abraham, in which God famously does not say that Sarah had said, and Abraham is old, but instead, I am old. So in this passage here, without going into the nitty-gritty of each story, fundamentally the message is, you can alter the truth, and it may even be a mitzvah to alter the truth in order to save peace. Another example is source number 16, the wedding passage. This always strikes me as very funny because it's a very happy, fun wedding song, right? Kate said Maraktan, it's a beautiful song, but they don't go through the rest of the passage. How does one dance before a bride? The school of Shammai taught, we sing based on who the bride is. Whatever she is, find something to say. The school of Hillel said, we sing, Kala Nava Chasuda, she's a pretty and pleasant bride. That's what you should say. It doesn't matter who she is. It doesn't make a difference what you think. That's what you say. And the school of Shammai said to the school of Hillel, and I apologize if this is going to offend anyone, but this is the text as it is. If she is lame or blind, will you still say this? The Torah says, distance yourself from falsehood. How can you say such a thing? The school of Hillel replied, according to you, if someone makes a bad purchase in the market, should you praise it in his eyes or insult it in his eyes? I'd say one should praise it, since it's not your business to make people feel bad because you don't appreciate the beauty of their bride. If you have a problem with the way she looks, then keep it to yourself. That's the response of the school of Hillel. He says, you say she's beautiful, and that's all you should say. So once again, they're being told that they should simply express something that will make people feel good, rather than express something that could be painful for people. This is not a case of danger to life. The issue is not a life and death matter by any stretch of the imagination. Nonetheless, there is a greater value than sharing your opinion with the world. That's the thrust of what you see here. And there are a few different schools of thought, rabbinically, in terms of how to understand this, given that we do emphasize truth so strongly. So one approach, I'm going to say this a little quickly, but one approach, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, also known as the Rama, in a responsum, made the statement that it's simply a matter of weighing competing values. And he says, there is a value of honesty and there's a value of peace, and peace is the higher value. Peace overrides the prohibition. That's in source number 17. That's one view. A second view argues in source number 18 from Ritva, Rabbi Yom Tov Elasvili, he says, no, the prohibition doesn't apply. The prohibition against lying does not apply at all in this case. It's not that it's being overridden. It's not called lying. Lying is where you intend to inflict pain, you intend to profit, you intend to hurt somebody else. That's not what this is. This isn't a lie. It's a statement that's not true, but it's not a lie. That's a second approach. A third approach, somewhat creative, comes from Rabbi Yigal Shaffrin. I alluded to this before in source number 19. And Rabbi Shaffrin makes the argument that it's okay to lie if there is an aspect of truth within the lie. So in source number 19, he says, look, there are two truths here. You, the onlooker, think that she's not attractive. The guy thinks that she is attractive. So you're not lying, you're just expressing his truth. Instead of expressing your own opinion, you're expressing the husband's truth. So there's nothing wrong with doing it, as long as there is some validity to that perspective. It's an interesting point of view. The upshot of this is that the emphasis Judaism places on truth telling does allow for exceptions. And that's really what I wanted to show here. Now we can come back to our cases and see how we deal with the cases that we outlined in the beginning. First of all, informing the stage 3 patient that her condition is serious, but we have treatment options. So the traditional position on a terminal case, this isn't a terminal case, but the traditional position on a terminal case is, since generally speaking, the assumption is we're not strong on patient autonomy, and since there is a view, and it's a strong view, that bad news is going to affect health in a negative way, and since lying, shading can be justified, particularly if the prognosis is not 100%, so therefore, we're not going to tell a patient about a terminal illness, and that tends to be applied in cases of serious illness as well. We don't need to tell them just how serious it is. And there are sources to support it. Take a look at source number 20, please. From the book of Malachim, the book of Kings. Hazael, who is from the nation of Aram, comes and stands in front of the prophet, the Jewish prophet Elisha, and says to him, your son Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, has sent me to you with an inquiry. Shall I die of this illness? Okay, the non-Jewish king has sent his agent to go ask Elisha, the Jewish prophet, am I going to die? And Elisha said to him, go tell him you shall surely live. But you should know, God has shown me that he shall surely die. He says, I know, he tells Hazael, the servant, he says, the truth of the matter is that he is terminal, but you know, better just to tell him that he's going to live. So that's one source that gets quoted in support of this idea. Another source comes from a story that was the opposite. A passage also in that same book, and actually in the very next chapter in that book of Malachim, involving King Chizkiyahu. King Chizkiyahu is a Jewish king. He becomes ill, and the prophet Yeshaya comes to him and says to him, you should know that you're going to die, and you shall not live. And look at the reaction in source number 21. This is a midrash on that story. When Chizkiyah became ill, God told Yeshaya, go tell him, instruct your household, for you shall die, you shall not live. Chizkiyah said to Yeshaya, Yeshaya, normally one goes to look after the sick, and one says to him, they shall have mercy upon you from heaven. The doctor goes to him and says to him, eat this, don't eat that, drink this, don't drink that. And even if one sees that he is dying, one doesn't say to him, instruct your household, lest he become upset. And you tell me, instruct your household, for you shall die and you shall not live? How dare you tell me that I should take care of my estate? This very strong negative reaction gets quoted. Now, you could argue regarding both of these cases. First of all, these are prophets. And therefore, you could argue they're just doing what God told them to do. Don't deduce what we should be doing based on that. That argument can be made. You could argue that Chizkiyahu is just telling Yeshaya a point of etiquette. This really isn't a nice thing to do, or you could have found a better way to say this, as opposed to making a statement of Jewish law. Nonetheless, when you come to practical rulings by rabbis, they tend to side against informing. Take a look at source number 22 as an example. Rabbi Bezalel Stern, who started out in Hungary in the first part of the 20th century, and then story of Jews in the 20th century, he went from there to Italy post-war, then he went to Australia where he founded a yeshiva, then he ended up in Vienna, finally was in Jerusalem for the end of his life, was asked the question about informing a patient about cancer. And he said, it is not at all correct to trick the patient, telling him his illness is not serious, and in a little while he will become stronger and will be healed, such things which people generally tell a patient to calm him and settle his mind. For since there truly is no natural cure for this illness, who knows whether he will merit to be saved? You can't promise him he's getting better. Therefore, even though one should, he says, one should conceal from the patient the knowledge that his illness has no natural cure, one should not delude him regarding the knowledge that his illness is serious. Tell him this is a serious illness, just don't tell him how serious it is, essentially what he wants. Through this, he will strengthen his prayers, make his accounting, and account with his Creator from the walls of his heart. That was the position of Rabbi Stern. Rabbi J. David Bleich, writing more recently, he's still at work in writing in New York today, says that he does not believe that you should inform the patient. Take a look at source number 23. He refers you to the report from Dr. Kubler-Ross. He says, I am perfectly willing to grant her, Dr. Kubler-Ross, the benefit of any possible doubt. I am also willing to concede there were no adverse physical effects in any of those 200 patients. Having done so, I nevertheless find no contradiction in her reports to anything found in rabbinic literature. They did not contend, the sages, that this result would obtain in all cases, or even in the majority of cases. They contended only that it may occur in some cases. They did not even hint at how small that minority of cases might be. And all forms of inductive reasoning fall short of ultimate proof and demonstration, because one cannot examine every possible case. Who knows what might happen in the case of the 201st patient? In an article entitled, Should the Doctor Tell the Patient That the Disease is Cancer? Surgeon's Recommendation, Victor Gilbertson and Owen Wangenstein advocate full disclosure. They cite statistics that, in their opinion, augur in favor of disclosure. 4% of surgical patients who received such information became emotionally upset upon learning the nature of their affliction and remained so through the course of their illness. And his response is, 4% is an awful lot of people.
But that doesn't mean they got sicker.
Correct. But his argument is you don't have any way to know. That's his argument. And again, we're coming back to that, including from Rabbi Bleich. He says, any benefit attendant upon disclosure that may be enjoyed by some patients must be weighed against the serious harm such disclosure may cause others. That's his position. And he says it's not called lying as far as he's concerned. He points out Hugo Grotius was a Dutch scholar who said you should never ever lie. But the question was put to him, what if somebody comes to you and says, where is the rifle? I would like to shoot you. Are you going to tell him where the rifle is? And the answer is no. He's not entitled to that information. So Rabbi Bleich says the same thing is true here. This patient is not entitled to this information that could be harmful to the patient. There's much more to say within this, but I want to make sure to get to some key points, and I'm seeing the time. So there is an important note here, and this goes back towards the question of what if there are things the patient is going to want to take care of? And indeed, that value is found within Jewish law. If you take a look at source number 24, passage in the Talmud, and this is the issue of confession, of admitting one's sins, for one who is ill and dying, they tell him, admit, for thus all who are to be executed admit. There's some debate as to whether those last words are supposed to be in what you tell him or whether that's the narrator speaking to the reader in the Talmud. Whether you just say to him, admit, without telling him, and anybody who's going to be executed is supposed to admit. But the point is, you are supposed to tell them to admit. So how do you do this? Take a look at source number 25 from the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch. This is the piece that precedes what we read before about the women and children being present in source number 12. Rabbi Caro writes, for one who is dying, they tell him, admit. And they say to him, many have admitted and not died, and many have not admitted and have died. As a reward for admitting, you shall live. That's a funny mistake there on the sheet. As a reward for admitting, you shall live. And all who admit have a portion in the next world. So you tell him, you know, people can still live. I had this terrible incident happen. Rabbis have a manual called Hamadrich. It's a very valuable thing. It's a resource for all sorts of life cycle occasions. So when I was a synagogue rabbi, I went to my first bedside where I had to actually tell the patient to do this. And I'm scared out of my mind, you know, as it is. And I have the book, and I'm all set. And I say to him, you know, people do. I run through the script properly and everything else. I'm about to hand him the book so he could read it out. And then I see at the top of the page, it has this script. Make sure to tell the patient. Many people have done this and live, which really takes the teeth out of saying how to say it. If you tell them I saw it on the page. So I quickly tore the top of the page out of the book and handed him the rest. You don't want it to be a script. You don't want him to see that. But that's the argument: is you can do this in an encouraging way. And the same thing is true regarding instructing one's estate. There's great value placed. Source number 26 speaks of a treatment that Talmud prescribed to try to help people live long enough to take care of their estate. But nonetheless, you can take care of this without giving full information about the person's estate. You can say, it will be a good idea to take care of this now, before getting into a position where things are so dire. Having said that, there is pushback within the halachic system, particularly because of the way modern medicine works. And at last we get to the point that several people have mentioned. Take a look at source number 27. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, aside from being a world-renowned expert in Jewish law, was also the head of the Department of Internal Medicine B for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel for decades. So he's writing with knowledge of what goes on. And he says the following, after having presented the view of hiding information, he says, but today it is very hard to hide from a cancer patient the nature of his illness, and especially as most of them are treated via radiation and chemotherapy or in an oncology unit or clinic. Further, thank God, the success rate for treating these patients is increasing. And in many cases, they can not only extend the patient's life, but actually completely cure his illness. And if they don't directly inform the patient of the nature of his illness, along with the hope of his treatment, he will certainly think the worst of his situation. Just the opposite. Lack of knowledge, and worse, wrong and deluded knowledge, will bring him to despair and depression. On the other hand, when they tell him of his illness, he will be able to reveal to the doctor his thoughts and fears, and an open conversation will be possible to encourage him and give him the emotional support which is so important and necessary. That's the flip side, which, again, has already been expressed here, but it's important to recognize that it's there in the halachic literature. I quoted before Professor Shimon Glick from Israel, who adds the following points. Treatment with new methods requires patient consent. Experience has shown in many cases patients can deal with it well. Honesty has independent value in relationships, especially patient-doctor communication. There are so many caregivers on a case that it's very, very difficult to imagine that all the caregivers are going to be able to hide this information from the patient. Failure to tell when you're found out is going to reduce trust in the medical profession overall. All sorts of reasons why today the advice of not telling is extremely problematic. Not to mention the note we had from before about questioning the whole mind-body relationship. So the result of this is that contemporary guidance that I have understood, that I've seen, is basically to tell if you're able to do anything in terms of treatment. Meaning, the stage 3 breast cancer case, to tell, to give full information, have the conversation, explain and highlight all of the different ways that it can be dealt with. And in a case that's terminal, or the doctors expect to be terminal, then what you find is a more split decision. Rabbi Shaffrin writes in source number 28, and this is the point that I cited before about the good of the patient, one should realize that at its foundation, meaning of the recommendation not to tell, is only the good of the patient and consideration of his situation. The import of this fact is that if there were to be a situation or case in which the good of the patient dictated the opposite, meaning on the contrary, to tell the patient of his condition, for this would help him more, then it would appear clear we would prefer to tell him the truth. And Rabbi Shaffrin makes a really interesting point. We have a law that says the following. Well, first of all, we know, in the event of a life or death situation in Jewish law on Shabbat, we break Shabbat in order to save the patient. That's basic principle, chok v'lo yavor, that's what we do. What about the following case? A woman is going to give birth, and she says, it's dark in the room, they can't really help me properly because they can't see, turn on a light. So the rule is, what do? You turn on the light. What if the patient, this woman who is giving birth, is blind? But she says, everybody else who's helping me, they need to be able to see. What do you do? What if you feel like you don't really need the light? What do you do? You turn on the light. Anyway, it's Code of Jewish Law, source number 29. A woman who is giving birth is like a dangerously ill patient, and we violate Shabbat for any of her needs, and we light a lamp for her, even if she is blind. Says Rabbi Shaffrin, no one suggested just telling her the light is on. Why did nobody make that suggestion? Someone over there did. Sorry. Okay. Why don't we make that suggestion? Well, we're okay with lying, right? No, we're not. We're not okay with lying. Let me make sure that I didn't come across saying that. That's on my recorder here.
Because of the light off.
The answer, well, that's true. Liability, can you imagine? The issue is not lawsuits. The issue here is that if she knows that the law on the books is that you can tell her it's on when it's really not on, then she's going to lose confidence in those who are taking care of her. Rabbi Shaffrin said the same thing is true over here. If patients know that you can lie and not really tell them, they're not going to trust you. You're undermining the entire doctor-patient relationship. That's the point that he makes. And this is recognized by none other than Rabbi J. David Bleichin, source number 30. Rabbi Bleich, who spoke so vociferously before about not telling the patient and not risking the health, says, nevertheless, in source 30, in the real world, there certainly are exceptions. First, an exception must be admitted in a situation in which disclosure is necessary in order to secure the cooperation of a patient in his treatment. Second, there are situations in which the patient is bound to discover the truth and he may learn the nature of his illness and circumstances that will cause greater harm, and so on. So he recognizes that there are going to be exceptions to this. Keep in mind, this is not an adoption of the idea of patient autonomy. This is not a rejection of the mind-body link or the idea that knowledge like this could be harmful. It's simply a recognition that there are additional factors in play today which change the game. That's the way that they are approaching it. So what we've said in terms of our practical case is that where you have the ability to treat, the sense seems to be that because of the way things work today, you need to have the ability to tell the patient, to secure the patient's cooperation, to alleviate the patient's fears, to make sure there's open communication. This will be something that will be important. What about the last case, the second case, second and last, which is the hospice conversation? So the traditional position has been not to say. I brought you source number 31. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham said, if at this point you have nothing you can do, then he says there's no reason to reveal to the patient his condition or the nature of his illness. Just tell the close family, and that's all. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said something similar. So what about moving the patient into hospice? Now what do you do?
What about all the benefits?
I'm sorry, I skipped one point. You just reminded me. You were going to say?
What about all the benefits?
Right, what about all the benefits of telling? Correct. So first of all, I want to just make sure I mentioned, I forgot to put it in before, but the point about the patient being able to say, if the patient says to you, I don't want to know, you have very clear marching orders. The patient has told me, I don't want to know, and then all bets are off in terms of this conversation.
You also have to not ask the patient what they want. So many times we have patients where they say, don't tell them, but then there's a decision if you want to go to the hospital, if you want to stay home. It's not fair to ask the patient what they want.
Well,
you haven't disclosed to them what their situation is.
Unless the patient says, I don't want that information.
If they say they don't want that information, you can then come to them the next time and say, okay, well, do you want to stay home or do you want to stay home?
Why are you not able to ask them that question?
They have no information. They don't have the right information. They're not informed.
Right, but they say, I don't want to make my decision on that basis. I know plenty of cases in which people, have said, whatever happens to me, I want it to end at home. And they don't even know what they're going to get sick from. This is years before. They made that decision, they've told their children, this is who they want to be, this is how they want to be dealt with. It doesn't matter what they're actually suffering from. So if a patient says to you, you're entitled to say to the patient, are you sure you want to make this decision without knowing what's going on? And the patient is entitled to say, yes.
But the patient can't decide what they want to do when it's not necessarily realistic thing. It's the same way as saying they want to cut their nose off because they think that's going to cure their breast cancer.
Are you speaking ethically or medically? No, seriously.
Look, I don't think it's appropriate to ask a patient, okay, you're very sick, do you want to stay home or do you want to go to hospital? If they don't know, that really there's nothing they're going to do in the hospital.
So you're going to force the patient to know, or are you going to just say, I'm not letting you make a decision?
If they don't want to know the information, then they can't make the decision for themselves, because it's not a valid decision.
But neither option that you're suggesting, I think, is tenable.
No, someone else can make the decision. Someone else can evaluate and decide.
But it's not a situation for an SDM. The person is alive and competent in everything. They have not licensed anybody to make the decision for them. You can't go to a substitute decision maker for somebody who is fully competent and simply says, I want to be an ignorant decision maker.
Yes, you can.
Really?
If the person says, I don't want to know,
I want this person to decide.
Tell that person to decide. I'll do whatever they say.
Yeah, that they can do, but this person hasn't done that. This person has said, I want to make the decision without the knowledge. Dr. Pito. Yeah.
My late father-in-law woke up from surgery.
I'll repeat it. Yeah.
He looked at the surgeon and said, well, doc, is it cancer?
Mm-hmm.
The surgeon couldn't say the needle point. So he made it clear that he needed to know.
Why?
And he had the courage of his conviction to ask the question straight up.
Right. So you're talking about where a patient asks the question straight out and says, doc, is it cancer? So I will tell you that of the sources we've looked at, there were those who were willing to go to the extent of saying that if the patient says to you, tell me, and you say, I don't want to tell you anything, and he says, I want you, or no, sorry, you say to him, it's good news, and the patient says, I want you to swear that it's good news, you are actually able, according to some who I looked at in preparing this, you are able to lie under oath in Judaism in order to give the patient good news rather than do something that would endanger the patient. There are those who are willing to go that far with this position. Now, again, they're not positions that are taking into account the fact that nowadays they have all these complicating factors. But it's worth knowing that there are those who will go that far with this. I respect what you're saying in terms of wanting the patient to know before making a decision. I just don't think you can compel them to go along with you. I'd be very curious to hear what a lawyer would say.
I can't accept their decision because it's not a valid, not an informed decision.
Right. You know what? I see that I have like 4 minutes left, and I want to. Sorry, I can ask the lawyer. That's right. All right, I'll ask the lawyer, but then I really want to get to the last point here.
This one also says you still, of course, must inform this host family. This host family is going to
go. Yes.
And Rabbi Mike said on the previous source that one exception to his view is the case that I may find out.
Yes.
But, well, in 2017, isn't there an added consideration that the patient is going to see it on someone's Facebook or email or something?
Yes, absolutely. That, yes, there are more ways for people to find out things they never wanted to know than ever. This is true. Right. Right. This is true. So I want to address the hospice case where you're going to let them know. You're going to let them know almost by accident. And just in case anybody leaves without signing in, please make sure that you don't. Please make sure that you sign in if you didn't do so, especially if you want credit. In terms of hospice, so Moshe Feinstein's position, articulated in source number 32, is that you have to continue to treat a patient even when there's nothing that you can do besides give him, you know, food, painkillers, whatever it is. That at least you have to do. You can't let a patient believe that a patient is being abandoned, that nothing more is being done. He'd like you to avoid doing something that will cause the patient to give up hope, which would seem to imply that if the patient has the opportunity to say, well, the patient, if the physician has the opportunity to say, we're not going to continue the chemo, we're not going to continue the radiation and so on, but the patient doesn't know what's going on, that Rabbi Feinstein would say, you have to find something to do in order that the patient should believe that there is still some sort of hope. On the other hand, take a look at Dr. Edward Burns. in an article on hospice care from 2015. He says, as to the concern of not telling the patient, in my experience, that situation is usually a fiction created by the family with good intentions as they try to save the patient from depression. In reality, when someone is racked with pain, is losing weight rapidly, and is too weak to perform everyday tasks, they know absolutely that something is terribly wrong. It may be much more kind to inform the patient and then make his or her remaining time more meaningful with expressions of sympathy and love, having friends visit to comfort. It enables one to confront the real problems of the terminally ill, such as pain relief and nonspecific terror that they experience from not knowing why they are so sick. In addition, knowing their diagnosis allows them to become meaningfully involved in future planning, such as creating or updating wills, making their wishes known to spouse and children. It is important to realize, however, that telling or not telling a patient the truth about their condition is a halachic question that needs to be discussed with a competent rabbinic advisor. Cop out. He was doing fine until the end. But the truth of the matter is that this is the tension involved in a hospice decision. So I want to tell you a couple of sources that, again, I added to the list, to the source sheet after this was already printed by the shul. I'm going to send it out into the follow-up email. But the truth is, there are two approaches that I've seen among hospice providers in terms of the way they present themselves. And one source that I found on the Hospice Toronto website, and their push is adding life to days. As opposed to adding days to life, adding life to days. And so they say, the miracle isn't in the cure, it's in the caring, and they talk about relief from pain, and they talk about clients choosing how to spend their final weeks or months of life, giving them this kind of control. It's a recognition that there's nothing more we can do. The prognosis is that they're not going to live past, in the case of Hospice Toronto, 12 months, and therefore, whether inpatient, at home, whatever it is, they're not going to, it's 12 months. 12 months for them.
Nothing more.
Yes.
There is always something.
Fair enough.
And they're palliative care in the state. I remember we had lessons that said there's always something we can do.
Okay, this is fair.
That's a language that.
Okay, I retract the words, there's nothing more we can do. We are not able to cure the patient's disease. Is that a fair statement? Whether you want to use those words to the patient. And that's one approach. The other approach I pulled off of the website of something called OmniCare Hospice. It's in the States. And they write the following on their website. Does hospice mean you're going to die? The short answer to this question is no. I mean, everyone is, but yes. The short answer to this question is no. In order to qualify for hospice care, your loved one must have received a prognosis of life expectancy of 6 months or less from their doctor. This doesn't mean they're going to die in that time. It just means the doctor feels they could possibly pass away within 6 months. It's important to mention here that sometimes hospice patients enter and leave hospice care as their health improves or declines. They go on to say, many patients who receive hospice care are expected to die soon. But research shows that many people now survive hospices. It's not uncommon for patients in hospice care to get better. Miracles can and do happen. Entering hospice care no longer means that your life expectancy is short. There is life after hospice. It does, doesn't it? According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in 2014, about 1.3 million patients received hospice care. Although 29% had a diagnosis of cancer, the remaining 71% had other life-limiting diseases. Of all patients, 11% were live discharges. 13% survived the six-month period. And they go on to say it's difficult to predict and you don't really know, and you say 6 months and that's your best estimate, but it isn't guaranteed. The point is that what I think we're seeing here is, given the weight in Jewish tradition of not wanting to say to a patient that in fact we can't cure you, and that it seems like it seems to us that the disease is in fact terminal, because we have such weight to the sources that say we don't want to do that. And on the other hand, we have reasons, many of them modern, to say you got to be open with the patient, whether it's to help the patient make an informed decision, whether it's because of the honesty important for the communication, whether it's because the patient is going to come to the conclusion anyway or come to a wrong conclusion instead, all the different reasons for why we would want to tell. It would still be better, it seems to me, to use the OmniCare approach not to be dishonest with the patient and say, you're going to be fine, we just want to take you here because they have better aspirin. But to say to the patient, the fact that you'd be going into hospice does not mean we have given up. The button would come in handy in this case. It doesn't mean that we've given up. It doesn't mean that we're not treating you. And it doesn't mean that all hope is lost because people do come out. But the patient should fundamentally understand the import of the situation, but take the edge off of it. One last item. Dr. Kirshen had asked the question of how one tells and who tells. So in an article in the journal Asia out of Israel, Dr. Batsheva Hershkovitz wrote an article in which she made the point that whoever's taking care in the hospital should really consult the family physician about this. I don't know how that works practically within the medical system here, but it's better for the family physician who knows the family, who knows the patient, should be the one to decide when and how to tell the patient. There's more to be said about that, but I think at this point I've spoken long enough. Thank you very much. I'll stick around for more questions such as they are, and again, I'm going to follow up via email. If anyone has to go, you can go. I'm going to still take questions. Thank you. Yes.